Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. This week, I'm joined by Angus Castle-Doughty. Angus is an actor and filmmaker known mostly for portraying Eric Foster in the award-winning incel storyline at Hollyoaks. After taking it upon himself to lose weight for a role in a major Netflix series, he developed disordered eating and muscle dysmorphia symptoms. Now he's making a film in response to that experience and in a bid to increase public awareness of male eating disorders. Angus has been seen in beloved TV shows since 2020, and now he's stepping behind the camera to tell this important story.
Yeah, breakfast is the best meal of the day. Like, I refuse to not have breakfast because it's my favourite meal.
Starting to have breakfast was part of me, like, repairing a relationship with food, to be honest, because I'd intermittent fasted for, like, 5 years. And wow. I started doing, like, what they don't tell you is intermittent fasting is meant to be a short thing, not necessarily a lifestyle.
No.
But I was, like, scared of breakfast, but I was so grumpy. And my girlfriend was like, you are insufferable. Can you please eat some food? So I started having breakfast. My weight stopped fluctuating, and I wasn't a complete pain in the ass to be around. So,
yeah.
Again, now it's my personality.
Yeah, I find it really interesting though, because for me, like, breakfast is a non-negotiable, whereas my partner, he doesn't have breakfast. And I'm always like, why don't you have breakfast? Because to me, I'm like, oh my God, like, what's going on? And for him, like, he's just not hungry. And he finds if he does have breakfast, he then is so less productive in the morning. And then he will, like, basically have, like, his breakfast before bed, if that makes sense. So he'll, like, have, like, porridge or something
breakfast. He likes the taste of it.
Yeah, it's not that he doesn't, like, and if, like, we're out somewhere or whatever and everyone's having breakfast, he'll have breakfast, but he just finds for, like, his day-to-day life, like, having breakfast doesn't help him, and, like, he's not hungry. And I think that just, like, to me, when he would, like, explained it to me, I was like, wow, that's, like, an amazing approach to have, because for me, I have to have breakfast, because I'm like, if I skip breakfast, then I know I'm going down the wrong path. Yeah. But it was really interesting to hear his perspective.
Well, I like, as part of doing this, I have to think about social media. And I've been, like, writing some TikToks to do, which is quite funny because I turn 30 next year and I still don't know what I'm doing with TikTok.
I work in social media and I don't get TikTok.
I don't get it. Like, I've got friends whose careers in the past 2 years have been... they've, like, shot to the moon because but they're musicians, but they were putting stuff on TikTok. And I'm like, am I missing something here? Because I don't know how to do this. Anyway, I've been writing some TikToks, and one of them is about how, and you have to start, you've got to start inflammatory, hook them in the first 10 seconds.
Yeah.
And one of them is about how intermittent fasting is ruining your relationship with food, because you start, it's inherently restrictive. You start the day by restricting yourself, and then end the day by restricting yourself, because there's a finish time as well.
Which just takes all joy out of anything and all flexibility.
My partner is she loves, her favorite meal of the day would be brunch. If she could choose when to eat, she would eat at 10 o'clock and it would be a little brunch. Her favorite food used to be an all-day vegetarian breakfast, but I've not seen her eat one in ages, so I don't think she could. It always annoyed her that I was, like, I was militant about fasting, because I was like, this is the only way. And you, like, lie to yourself and go, well, you know, it brings down your amino acids and increases your rate of productivity by a factor of 37%. But yeah, it's nonsense. Sorry to say. Sorry, don't come and get me, pseudoscience food people. But all you're doing is eating less in a day.
Yeah, exactly. That's the science. And intermittent fasting, everybody goes on about how it's for health and everything. I'm sorry, but it's a diet. It's a way to lose weight. Like, that's it.
And I took it to extremes. My most restrictive. And I'm not going to, like, I don't blame anyone for this, but this was, like, advice I was given by other actors. But they clearly, I don't know, they've never had to worry about their weight so much. So for them, it's just like a case of getting really comfortable with feeling like good naked on camera. But I was like, oh, this is what I was told to do. And obviously, because I was severely under eating, I went gaunt within the space of like, I don't know, a month. And I did that for 6 months. But then again, like the thing with my my new career as a TikTok influencer, I was writing what things that I thought were hard work and they were actually just a sign of an eating disorder. And one of them was the cheat meals I'd have on a Sunday. I'd like watch people eating food all week on YouTube. Like mukbangs. I loved any middle-aged man eating a burger in his van, and I was in.
Mine was Man versus Food. I just used to watch that all the time.
Yeah.
Come dine with me, Man versus Food, any cooking show, anything.
Yeah.
People don't realise that that's a sign of disordered eating and undereating. But, you know, if you're obsessing over, I would spend hours reading recipe books. I would watch the TV. I would talk about food all the time and also cook a lot for other people. Like, I'd do loads of baking, but never eat it myself.
Right. I mean, that the talking about food, I still do that and talk about, like, weight a lot now. And we just got back from Ibiza, and it was lovely, but it was like the first time that I was going into it and I was like, I'm gonna put on weight and that's okay because I'm on holiday. By the end, it really wasn't okay, and I was like, it was the last day, it was all I was thinking about. And but my partner was like, you're going to ruin your last day if you worry about this. And I was like, I can't stop thinking about it. And then, like, I was sort of doing some analysis as to why that, like, because I'd cognitively gone, it's okay to gain weight on this holiday because I'm on holiday. It's literally the point.
I don't agree. I think people have this mentality at Christmas and holidays. They have this mentality that it's Christmas and holiday, so I'm going to gain weight. And they almost give themselves this free rein to eat as much as they possibly want, because in their day-to-day life, and like, not, I'm not saying this for you specifically, but I think people are so restrictive with what they eat. And then they're like, okay, we're on holiday, I can free rein it.
But
now.
That was exactly it. And
but if you have that free rein all the time when you're on holiday, you don't feel necessary that you do need to eat loads more. And equally, if you do eat a bit more, when you come back and you get back into your normal routine, your weight settles anyway.
It was, and like, you're spot on, because the way I was eating out there was just another sign of what goes on in my head. It's like every time I go on holiday, unless I've sort of made, I don't know, sometimes go on holiday and I'm in a more like balanced place, and then, like you say, there's no need to overeat or undereat, and you don't fluctuate. But this time around, for whatever reason, I thought I was being healthier to my brain by going, if part of your brain says don't eat that, then eat it, because that's a restrictive part of your brain.
Yeah.
And don't listen to that. So, you know, the no none of my nephew's chocolate was safe in my path. And it was a bad week to be a little beer in the Balearic Islands because I was ploughing my way through them. But I was okay with that and was okay with the idea of gaining weight on holiday. And then I came home and was like, actually, I'm really not okay with this. And I realized it was because there's, and it reminded me of a couple of years ago when I was really restrictive. It, like, if I gained weight, I thought it was permanent. It wasn't like a natural state. It's like, oh, and there was an association with just like a lot of the same cycles. And to be honest, I think it's from doing this film that some stuff is getting dredged up again because I'm like thinking about it all the time.
Yeah. And that's what I was going to say. I was going to ask where you think that your relationship with food is now and whether the movie has brought stuff up for you, because it sounds, you know, from what you were saying, like you were okay to gain weight because you were on holiday.
Yeah.
But like if you gained weight like being at home, no, that's totally not okay. Mm. And it's like, you know, those rules and that sort of like it's okay because and you know, I will have the same thing of like, oh, I'm okay to eat this now because of this rule. And I think a lot of the time people think, oh, I've got a really healthy relationship with food, but actually there's still so many behaviors at the core of it and rules that you kind of say, oh, well, everyone else does that in society, so it's totally fine.
And my mum, she won't mind me saying this, she said something similar on holiday. My dad was like, oh, yeah, you get this from me and your mum. Sorry about that. And they were like, yeah, sorry about that. And it also never really goes. And I was like, thanks, guys. Mm. But again, like, I don't blame them at all. Everything was fine until it absolutely wasn't. And that was also a choice that I had made. Like, I could have easily gone, oh, I don't care how I look in this naked scene, which, by the way, was cut.
Do you think you could have just gone, I don't care? I don't think it was an active choice that you made to care.
Yeah, I don't know. It's the feeling of something being up there forever, I think. And then vanity, mainly insecurity that looks like vanity. And also, like, there's so much of acting that is like, and it drives me up the wall when you hear people go, I'm working so hard. What do you mean? Like, what does that mean? There's so much out of your control. Mm-hmm. And this is an industry. Yeah, you can go to classes and you can work really hard on your auditions and emails and all that stuff. But like, you're not tarmacking the M6. What does it mean? So like, having a physical thing to put all that energy into, I think is like, it was always going to happen the moment there was a physical thing. And again, like in answer to your earlier question, this isn't, it's definitely, there was definitely a lot about that I was convinced was sort of healed that definitely wasn't. And the film, I mean, it's sort of the reason I made it. The film is definitely dredging stuff up, and I've had more flare-ups doing it than before I did it. But then again, like, I would always have flare-ups. When I was doing Hollyoaks, the frequency of being on camera and episodes coming out meant you could watch in real time how you changed over a year.
Yeah.
And I wasn't prepared for like that. And also, like, you could see how much you age over a year, which to me was quite dramatic. There was the climax of my storyline was an hour long special, and they showed a montage of like all the bits of my storyline leading up to that point at the start the episode. And I looked like a boy at the start, And then I went from 26 to 28 whilst I was there. And so aged. And I was a bit like, oh, I don't like seeing this. And one of the natural things is I imagine had an increase in testosterone. So I just got like bigger. And like my bone structure got bigger. And that flared a bunch of stuff up again. So I've always had flare-ups. It's not like after 2019, I was like, I know what this is. It's fixed forever. The film is just making me aware, like it's making me more aware when things are disordered or like dysmorphia based, as opposed to just, I'm a bit weird with food, I guess.
Do you think that's because of having more conversations with, you know, like you've had conversations with me, you've been speaking to charities and PhD candidates and stuff, and do you think maybe that's, you know, in day-to-day life, I think I found when I'm in my day-to-day life of like, you know, my friends, there are disordered behaviours that are completely normalised in life because that's just the way it is. But I know for me that I can't engage in them. Whereas then when I sit down, you know, because I have a lot of friends now through the podcast that have got that experience and we're all very hyper aware of that and sort of navigate away from that. But that has helped me to understand my behaviours a bit more in terms of like knowing what's disordered or what's, you know, actually okay, I guess, to, you know, it's just part of a healthy lifestyle.
Yeah, I do, like, one thing I would say is when I first wrote the film, I called it dysmorphic, but I was sort of, I still had a degree of separation of going, well, I don't think I can justifiably say I had an eating disorder because that feels like a heavy thing. I'll call it disordered eating and I'll call it muscle dysmorphia symptoms as opposed to muscle dysmorphia, because like it never felt like something that was serious enough, I guess, to be justified in that way. I definitely have a more clinical understanding of what I was going through and still sort of wrestle with. But again, like I do also think it's given me a better, talking to yourself and George and the charities is given me a better grapple on things. It's like this weird paradox. I know more, have realized more, but also, like you say, I'm better equipped to recognize things. I don't know if you knew Courtney, she went to Warwick, and she used to say, and so did a couple of my friends actually, I never really considered, because I didn't think about food at Warwick, but she always used to say, like, be careful about your exercise because you're quite obsessive with it. And I was like, that can't be a negative. In what world? Like, people are obsessed over drinking. I'm fine.
Because exercise is healthy. So that's totally fine.
Yeah. George said something interesting to me that I think he'd heard from someone else, that there's no AA for exercise addiction. And I'm not like, again, like that's something that I think I'll probably always... We were talking about this before. Like, I don't know how you find a balance between going, like, when you've got targets, I guess, or like fitness targets. I don't know how you can do that and not over-exercise. But then at the same time, I'm not an athlete. It's just...
Yeah. It's interesting because I think I mentioned to you before that I used to powerlift, obviously. That's how I got into fitness. And then I found that actually the powerlifting wasn't good for me in terms of like being in a weight category, and so went for something that didn't need a weight category, but then just because of lockdown went into HIIT training and got super obsessive over that. And I think the kind of place that I'm in now with exercise, one, I got a coach so that I'm not in charge. Mm. And so that, you know, I say to her, these are my goals and this is what I would like to achieve. And we spent a very long time of like unraveling a lot because I was so controlled over the exercise that I was doing. And, you know, she has sometimes said, like, I think you need to reduce your days and stuff. And I'm like, no, not happening. Like, yeah. You know, on the one hand, exercise is the thing that I do to kind of feel safe and feel comfortable because I have ADHD as well. It really helps to calm that. So then that's another thing that comes in. But I think it's very much recognizing, like, when am I doing this? You know, when am I reaching burnout with this? Like, when do I need to really stop? And that's something I really struggle with because I am definitely burning out a lot at the moment because of going self-employed. And so my coach has been like, I think we need to like reduce the intensity and stuff. And it's then when I realize that my relationship with exercise isn't where I want it to be because I don't have that flexibility to allow myself to. And I think that's fundamentally what it comes down to is you can have goals in fitness. Absolutely. Like, you know, whether that's going to be you want to do a triathlon or you want to learn to do a muscle up, things like that. And you can work towards them. But it's being able to say to yourself, today's not the day for this and I can actually have the day off rather than forcing yourself to go in, even though you're absolutely knackered, you're dragging yourself behind and you're not eating. I think that's another thing as well. If you're not eating to strive for those goals, then, you know, I think that's a number of things that shows it's probably quite disordered rather than being productive.
I mean, like, I'm exactly the same. Like, if, but I'd like, again, and my partner's been, she's always been great, but she's been really great with this. I've started to raise some money for the film. I'm doing face-to-face sales of flowers, trying to get people to buy some flowers, but it means I'm on my feet for like 14 hours a day. And and you're not like standing still, you're sort of being a wily boy. And he was like, you don't need to work this hard, like you don't need to exercise this much, you're exercising all day. And also you cycle a bike from the flower shop to the pitch. I was like, that doesn't count. Like, that's not the exercise. That's separate. And I know, like, I feel really guilty at times because I, not wanting to, but definitely project my own insecurities and worries onto my partner. And she's like, just because we haven't gone to the gym, it doesn't mean we haven't exercised today. I'm like, yes, it does. But I'm talking to myself. And then she's feeling guilty about it. And then I'm just transferring one toxic thought pattern onto someone else. And that, again, like doing this film, that's something that I've become more aware of that I wasn't aware of before. Yeah, it's interesting. Like I say, I went to the gym before we jumped on this. And I've been every day this week. I could have quite easily gone, I don't need to. I'm going to go sell some flowers today. But like, I don't know. There's a feeling, the same feeling of inadequacy and failure from that was what came up with dieting in 2019 is definitely associated with exercise. But that's, I like you say, there's a dichotomy because I enjoy it on some days, but then also I have, like, my body has this shut off safety catch where if I go into the gym and like within 2 minutes, if I'm like, I don't want to be here, I'll just leave. I won't drag myself through it. I was talking to my...
If you had a day off, let's say, and you didn't go to the gym, what is it that comes up for you? Like you said, that it's kind of, you know, similar to the relationship that you had with food and you feel guilty and bad about yourself. What is it like that you feel bad about?
Well, it's interesting because I have always been like, I take a day off a week, but I feel no feelings of guilt or inadequacy if it's a day of decide. If I'm like, what's happening? I'm not going to the gym. I'll wait.
But let's say today I said to you, Angus, you can't go to the gym because we're doing this podcast when you're going to go to the gym. And then you have no time for the rest of the day.
Yeah, I'd probably think about it at least for the first half of the day. I would then be able to have a conversation with myself, I think, and be like, well, it's fine. It's not the end of the world. But I would probably, I used to describe it as feeling itchy. I feel like itchy, and I'm neurodivergent as well. And I think part of it is just like, I just want to go and have a dedicated time for movement. And like, I feel a bit like a toddler where I'm like, I'll go work, wear myself out. So then, annoy other people.
And I will always say, I mean, I literally just said that 5 minutes ago, like the reason I like going to the gym is because of my ADHD, but I think I use that as an excuse to be like, I need to go to the gym in order to relieve whatever energy I've got, because I know for me, like, if I don't go to the gym, then you know what you were saying, like, oh, if you don't go 5 days, you might as well not have gone at all. Like, for me, it's if I don't go for that one day, all the strength I have built up is going to go. And like, I have such a thing in my head of being this admirable person that trains in a certain way because I'm 5'1" and I can lift 140 kilos, and people are like, that's insane, that's so cool. And it's just such a big part of my personality that for me, I'm terrified if I stop one day going to the gym, I'm going to gain all this weight and I'm going to lose all that motivation and dedication.
Yeah.
Because that's another thing people kind of always say, like, oh, you're so dedicated, it's amazing, because they glorify it, because exercise, like you say, is a massively normalized thing. And that for me is the fear of like, people are just going to judge me so much. But even more than that, I'm going to judge myself. And that's the worst, is judging myself, because nobody's probably ever going to say to me, oh, Hannah, you know, you've gained a bit of weight, or like, you don't look how you used to. But I will feel
it. Yeah, yeah,
I think
honestly,
that's the worst.
I like, you vocalized that in a really articulate way. That's it, is the self-judgment. I'll feel like I've let myself down. No one else would know, but I'll feel like I've let myself down. Also, on that, people don't say, no one's going to say you've gained a little weight because you don't look any different to other people. And I learned that from watching Shadow and Bone, and I was watching a scene where I hadn't started dieting, and a scene when I'd been 3 months into it, and I couldn't tell the difference. And my partner, but like, I never believe people. Like, my partner and my family and my best mate has been saying it. He's always like, it's in your head, you look exactly the same. And I've just gone, no, it's not in my head, because I can see it. So like, you might think that, but I can see where my body's changed. And also importantly, I can feel it. Like, I feel cumbersome, and that I feel, like you say, I feel like I let myself down. And hard work, being hard working, is, I've realised again this year, is a huge part of my personality, like how I feel like I identify, because, and this goes beyond like food and exercise, my acting career started doing well before anyone else's. I went to university, I didn't go to drama school, and then I was sending like 500 emails a day to get things off the ground and lying my way into plays. And I met my agents because I lied to a director and told him I was Irish and he was doing an Irish play. And we got there on the first day.
Did you do the accent, or did you just turn up without an accent?
I suddenly tried. I did.
I really hope that wasn't the attempt.
No, I did. I did the play. The play was an Irish play, and I had to, like, actually the accent there. And it, I saw an accent coach, so it was like pretty good. But for that first meeting, I was I greeted him, was like, "Oh, nice to meet you," and he was like, "You're not Irish." But then, yeah, people would always be like, "Oh, you've worked so hard, and like, look at what you've achieved, and that's so great." And people would always like, I felt like people looked up to me whenever I got a job, and
yeah.
Like I felt like when I didn't get a job, I'd let people down, and the industry has been in a horrible state of flux for about a year now, and I haven't booked something since. Like I've done stuff, I haven't actually had a casting director be like, "You got the job," since last August, and that's the longest I've gone. In that time, I've seen friends of mine. They're like 10,000 hours coming to fruition. They're touring the world and they're doing festivals and all sorts, and it's all happening for them. And I've had some of the biggest rejections of my life, and also some, like, I've been second choice like 5 times, which happens. Not generally in the space of 9 months, but like it happens to everyone. And I've felt.
Do you think that the kind of, way that acting is and how competitive it is has had a bigger impact and sort of augmented those insecurities? Because, you know, if you're going into a job that, you know, there's not that much competition. I can imagine you could go into your job, you work hard, and, you know, I'm not saying that then that's super easy, but I imagine with acting, it's similar. I did a podcast that came out this week actually with a professional ballet dancer, and she was saying that, like, you know, it's based so much on the way that you look. And if you're just as good as a dancer as someone else, then if they're slimmer than you, they'll probably get it. And so it is with acting, you know, there's so much based on your appearance, but then also your ability to act. And I can imagine that self-doubt and, you know, pushing yourself like in the gym and stuff.
I think the two are the same behaviours. Like, acting as a career is pretty disordered anyway, because there's so much you don't have control of that you try to control all the other things. Like my mum was a ballet dancer, funny enough, and her attitudes towards food and stuff are directly as a result of that. But the main thing that I wrestle with acting and looking a certain way is that I don't play characters with like muscle mass, and I carry muscle mass,
right?
So it's like it's a constant, like, and people will be like, "Oh, you're looking great, you look big," and I'm like, "Thank you, but shut up." Like when I was on Hollyoaks, I used to, before I got there, I'd train in the morning, I'd train in the evening, I'd do a spin class, and then I'd go do a weight session. I got to Hollyoaks and I didn't have the time or energy to do that. So I would like just prioritize weightlifting, and it meant I put on muscle quite quickly. And someone said to me, they were like, "Oh, we were just looking at you from up there." And by the way, my character on Hollyoaks was an incel. He was a little, like, internet in a dark room, skinny guy. Mm-hmm. And my friend was like, "Oh, we were just up there. We were, like, on the second floor. We were looking down. We're like, Jesus, has Angus always been that big? He looks incredible." And I immediately stopped weightlifting and started long distance running, like, the next day.
Oh, wow. So it wasn't like I think people think I look big, that's good, and I want to keep doing this. It was,
apart from anything else, the character looked like he could start breaking people's necks with his bare hands, which didn't suit.
Right.
But, like, that wasn't my intention. I was just exercising. And like the other thing is,
yeah,
again, I don't blame them. I wish they would have had just a small conversation with me before they did it. But I noticed that my costumes, the jumpers, he wore a lot of jumpers. He was big into knitwear, were getting bigger and bigger. Until one day I came in, there was an XL hanging on the peg. And I was like, that's ridiculous. I'm not like, why? I look ridiculous. Like I'm getting drowned out. And they went, oh, yeah, but you've just put on quite a lot of muscle. We have to cover it up. And I was like, what? Like, when you first started noticing this, why wouldn't you just raise it? As opposed to, because it's worse that I'm walking in and seeing how big these costumes are getting, because it's making me feel different kind of ways. And they were like, well, we're never going to stop you to, like, stop exercising. We're never going to tell you to stop exercising. And I was like, no, but I just change things. I don't like. So in that way, there's been a pressure to look a certain way. Also, like when I was really restrictive, I had full belief that if I went back up to the weight I was, this is how stupid this was. I was a weight, got cast in Shadow and Bone, came out, carried on the diet, believed that if I went back to the weight I was when I got cast in Shadow and Bone, I wouldn't book another job. Make that make sense. And so, like, kept dieting. But I often have that belief, like, I don't like doing tapes if I've audition tapes if I've had something that's going to bloat me out, because I feel like if I'm not my most defined on a tape, it's going to not work in my favor. And like, to be honest, I think there is some truth in that. And any, like, as much as casting directors and producers and directors will go, no, it's not about that, and they're really trying to move away from that kind of like ideal thing, it's a subconscious thing. You just like, someone looks better for a part or not. But the main thing is the fact that I put on muscle really easily, and I don't play any characters that carry any muscle.
Could you change that, or would that be just as bad if you changed it to be that your character, I guess, is that like letting the disordered mindset,
I mean, like,
win?
It's not
by...
really up to me. It's more, I have gone up for, I definitely, like, my agents will push me for things that I'm physically more attuned to. But for one reason or another, they've never stuck. I'm also like stunt trained, and I've got a physical theatre company. So I'm like chomping at the bit to play a character that can crack some skulls. But it doesn't. Yeah, it's not, so much is not up to you. And I think people see my eyes and go, well, he's perfect for this little weirdo we have. So, yeah, I'd love to, but...
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. And from my perspective, and this is just such a small example, but, like, for example, yesterday I had some headshots taken. My friend is really into photography, and she was like, I'll take some pictures for you.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it was absolutely horrific, because I spent the whole morning worrying about the way that I looked. And I was like, I don't, like you just said, I don't possibly want to eat anything that's going to bloat me slightly. And then she took the pictures and she showed me one, and I was like, I don't want to see them. And then I spent the whole afternoon worrying about what they look like. And then she sent me them, and I spent the whole evening like going through and picking apart everyone. And then I've been up since 4 a.m. comparing pictures of me yesterday to 9 months ago, when I was in the deep dark depth of anorexia. And, you know, that's for me why I avoid my body being on camera or having my photo taken or things like that, to then be in an environment where not only am I going to be like have a photo taken, but I'm going to have a video taken where my body is going to move a lot. that's then put on television. Like, that was just a small example yesterday, but I can't imagine how their body dysmorphia, weirdly, what that is then like to be.
The video is better because you're moving. There's no, you can't really have a bad angle in a video. The other thing is they like, on the right thing, the kit is so expensive that like you'd be hard pressed to not look your absolute best when it comes out.
But then that would scare me even more if I don't look my absolute best on this fantastic equipment. What do I look like in normal life?
Yeah, that, I mean, the headshots thing is because we have to get them a lot. Causes some deep insecurity to come up because, like, also there's ones where they'll get you to laugh and stuff, and you're like, I don't like that because I look like an emoji, or like my face looks really wide.
Yeah.
And that, like, yeah, that's the hard thing. The tapes thing, though, like being like, I've got a tape, I have to drink lots of water and have non-inflammatory foods. That's like a daily thing. And like I said, exactly what you're saying, Hollyoaks, it did. Watching your fluctuations in real time every year made it impossible. And there was like a known thing. It was like a thing that be like, if you know you weren't feeling great that day, don't watch that episode.
Yeah. But then it's almost an addiction to do so. Like, that's what I found this morning at 4 a.m. I was like, I do not want to sit here and compare these photos. But it feels the checking behaviours associated with body dysmorphia are so addictive, and that you think, I'll look at it and it'll be a sense of relief. And, you know, sometimes potentially it is a sense of relief for a few minutes or a few seconds. But then all of a sudden that kind of inner critic, that voice kicks in and it's like, nope. Like some of them I was looking at and I was like, oh, that's actually a nice picture. Yeah. And then it was like, nope. And then battling that again.
The thing, like, again, just bringing it back to dysmorphic for a second, that's the, and it's across fitness as a whole as an industry, but the before and after pictures as a thing, or progress photos as a thing, is that is like, it's exactly what that is, because you're, I did it and posted them, and I used to. And I also go back to photos, those progress photos now, to see if I look any different now. Like, I find myself, especially like if I'm having a bad day, will go back to those photos, especially when I was not only at my most restricted, that morning went for a run, had a sauna, and the night before had a hot bath with a glass of red wine to really like dehydrate myself. And we'll go, do I, like, is it in my head that I look different, or do I actually look different? And that's like, again, like, people just think it's normal to go, here's me. And the insinuation by going before and after pictures, here's me at my worst and look how great I am now.
Yeah.
And I don't even think people like, well, that's the thing. People don't realise what they're doing.
No, I don't think that people realise what they're doing to themselves, but also what you're doing to other people, because your worst could potentially be somebody else's best, or it could be better than maybe what they think their best is. So the impact, I don't think those kind of photos have a beneficial impact on anybody. But we are, you know, especially in fitness, we're so obsessed with showing what we define as better, and that is glorified and it's seen as hard work and it's dedicated. You know, I've got so many friends that have done like 6 week detoxes and they'll post before and after pictures, and I'm like, that's really cool for you, but send me a picture of what you look like in a week. Because once you get, it's like what we were saying earlier, once you get back to eating normally and back in your routine, I'm really great that, like, it's great that you've done that detox, but you've learned absolutely fucking nothing about like healthy eating also, or a healthy lifestyle.
Just lost a load of water away.
No, it's so, water. Like, yeah, yeah. And I can tell you, like you were saying earlier about going in the sauna and stuff, I literally, when I did my last powerlifting competition and I decided I'm never doing this again, I lost 7 kilos overnight. And like, that's madness. People would dream to do that. But I did it by not having no fiber for 3 days. I did a massive water cut. And then I sat in a bath from 4 a.m. till 7 a.m. sweating my tits off. And then I sat with a cup chewing gum to get the last few grams spitting water for a university level championship powerlifting competition. Like, that was when I decided this is not for me. This is such a jack shit. So bad, because I had no carbs in me. Like, literally, as soon as I did the weigh-in, and by the way, I got to the scales and I was 0.01 grams over. So you're allowed to keep your socks on. You have to keep your socks on, but you can take your pants off. So I had the tiniest pants on anyway and took my pants off, and it was like flickering on the weight. And she was like, get off the scales, you've made weight. But also because of the stress of not sleeping for a week, because I was so stressed about making weight. So I was absolutely knackered, had no carbohydrates in me. I literally, as soon as I weighed in, went and ate a whole malt loaf and just like engulfed it. And then just sat there eating like bags of bagels and stuff like that. But the stress of making weight meant that I had nothing left for lifting. And that was when I decided, like, I have been lying to myself saying that powerlifting is the thing that helped me recover from anorexia, because I needed to eat in order to lift. And actually what it did was it just gave me an eating disorder in a different way. And, you know, I massively overate as well, because I was trying to hit a calorie target that I'd been told I needed to eat, and was surrounded by powerlifters doing the same. But it massively messed up my relationship with my body, and, you know, trusting it and things like that. And just the fluctuations were awful. Before we dive off, I do just want to ask you, what is dysmorphic? I've had such a nice time talking to you about your personal experience, and actually you've woven in dysmorphic as well, and we can put it in the description, but just to kind of get a bit of an insight from you about what it's all going to be about.
Is a short film about a young guy who just wants to get a bit fitter and wants to start a fitness journey, and he's got really innocent ambitions, but immediately starts recognizing that there's people who have a different relationship with exercise and food to him. And then over the course of through social media and through other people in the gym, he starts getting sucked into really toxic ways of thinking. And we highlight the innocuous ways in which our families talk to us, and how that can affect disordered eating and make things worse when it's just all quite innocent. And then ultimately at the end, he's sort of, we finished the film and he's tied into something that he's going to need to recover to get out of. The film's got a cast of named actors from TV, which is quite fun. They haven't signed the contracts yet, so I can't say who they are. And we've got a great soundtrack being made by a guy who's made lots of TV soundtracks. And we're working with brilliant people like yourself and the charities to release it with a splash. Next week, we're launching a crowdfunder for anyone that wants to get involved, because films are well expensive. So it's costing me a fortune. So if anyone feels passionately about male eating disorders, because it is really underrepresented and underspoken about and underfunded, please check out the Greenlit page. It's greenlit.com/dysmorphic, and you can see what we're doing and get involved. That's amazing. The pitch.
That's the pitch. Amazing. I love it. I'm very excited. I think that what you're doing is brilliant. And it's like you say, it's something that's massively underrepresented. And I think more so underrepresented. Is that the word? Underrepresented. I'm saying titted at the end. It's underrepresented as an issue. You know, I think we're all very aware that there's people, and, you know, you'll say, oh, God, yeah, he's well obsessed with the gym, or like, oh, no, he won't go out for food because he has to have his chicken and broccoli or whatever. And it's like, yeah, that's the issue, that you're also now kind of making it more of a personality, yeah. and you're normalizing it as well. So
that's the thing. The thing that's blown my mind really with making the film and talking to everyone about it is that the biggest problem with the biggest preventer of early prevention is the fact that so many men don't realize that they have eating disorders. They just think, so our big focus is on saying that exercise is okay, it's good for you, and, you know, keep healthy. But we, like, if you're obsessing over it, you're struggling with something that you can recover from, but you don't, like, it's not a byproduct of working hard and getting into a new hobby. It's something that you need to work on, and there's help out there to work on, because the amazing charities we're working with are set up to, like, have really casual conversations about it, which would massively help, but they're only getting people coming to them when they're at crisis point, and then by that point there's health issues that come into it as well. So
I think that is because it is so glorified as a personality trait, or it's so normalized as well. And I think that, you know, people don't realize that if you're choosing exercise and like it's rigid rules around food over socializing, you know, that is actually an issue. That's kind of shouldn't be something that's normalized. And I think it makes it even more difficult when you're in a group of people that all do that, because then it's like, well, everyone's doing it. And so why shouldn't I? If all of your friends, I know that George had this situation of like all of his friends became people that were in the gym. So he wasn't missing out on social occasions because everyone was at the gym. That's how he socialized. And mine was the same with Warwick Barbell. So it's really difficult to recognize. But I think, like you say, you know, there is the support out there. And I think as well, a lot of the time people think, well, I don't want to ask for help because then I won't be able to go to the gym, or I won't be able to eat in a certain way. And it's like, no, you can still go to the gym and you can still do things that you feel is going to optimize your health, but it's just having that flexibility with it.
And to know, like, when to step away, when to engage. That's, I think, the biggest help for me. And also, like, it just reminded me when you said seeking help. The big thing I want to say to people about getting involved with the film and getting involved in the Greenlit campaign, we have such a campaign at the moment. Like, we have such a conversation around male mental health. Everyone's like, bro, talk to your bros. But you, like, people only ever mean suicide. They're just like, talk to your mates so that they don't kill themselves. Male eating disorders and muscle dysmorphia never comes into it. Like, what do you think people are experiencing before they get to the point where they're considering harming themselves? So I've started feeling really passionate about making the film. I feel like I've got a big responsibility in making it because the conversation is absent. And I would really love people to get involved because, you know, it's important. And, like, I hate the whole, like, actors and filmmakers have this real habit of self-aggrandizing their work. They're like, I'm telling a vital story. This isn't my story, though. Like, I'm feeling this is important because no one else has done it. So don't get me wrong, I would love to not be the one doing it. It's super stressful. But it's grown now, and it's a responsibility, and I'm taking it with both hands. So please get involved because I'd like to make it.
Well, thank you so much, Angus. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk about personal experience and then also talk about dysmorphic. I'll put all the details about how everyone can get involved in the show notes. And
thank you. See you in September. And thanks for your time. Have a lovely day.
Speak to you later.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode. So be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.